I mean, let's separate it into two pieces. One, I think the national surveillance system for respiratory enteric diseases that CDC has evolved over the last 4 years is better. They're tracking more diseases from more labs. If you go to the website, though, and look at the labs that are participating, it's highly limited. Mm-hmm. And so we do need to find, and I find the private sector to be very, very supportive. So I think figuring out how we ensure that there's continuous for a broader, I mean, there's one site in North Dakota, one site in Idaho, one site in South Dakota, and it looks like about 35 sites in Wisconsin. So, I mean, we're oversampling in urban areas. It's not giving us a good picture of respiratory disease in the less populated areas. And there's a way to do that in a very cost-effective way. And so I hope that happens. But that system is better. If you go to that site, they have very good data from this limited number of labs. And I thank the labs for voluntarily contributing. You can see where there's flu, RSV, and HMPV co-circulating. And that's important. And I hope that information is getting out because the COVID surge will be late because the summer surge went late into the fall. So I imagine it's not going to be really increasing until February, March, which puts us into flu B season, but at least out of RSV season. What I've been worried about with H5, and just to be honest, I was not significantly worried in the spring and summer when it was in the Midwest and Texas and some of the southern states, because there was no H1 human flu circulating. Mm-hmm. So there was no H1 circulating, and most of the human infections will result in a stopped infection, even if it's mutated in vivo inside that human, because usually those people where it mutates are highly sick. The mutation occurs because they have poor immunologic control of the virus. And so they go through many more replications, but usually those people are sick enough to be hospitalized and isolated. The reason I got concerned over the last month was in California, there's 700 of the 1,000 dairy herds infected with H5. 70% of the herds are infected. Less than 60 of those have moved through their infection and are no longer quarantined. So we have, you know, at least 62 or so percent of all dairy herds infected in California. And if you look at the H1 from the California, well, from the region 9, but it's, you know, heavily California, you'll see that flu H1 is like this. So H1 is dramatically expanding in California. So this will be the first time that we have significant H1 infection in the communities at the same time you have dairy workers at risk. And I just think, you know, clearly the principles of prevent, detect, and respond, detect is really critical. And I think we still, I think it's a matter of semantics. I think CDC is using asymptomatic in a very restricted way. And I mean it in a subclinical way. I mean it that the people who have gotten infected with H5 have been subclinical with minimal symptoms. Now, if you went back and you interviewed them and said, did you have a little sore throat or a dry throat one day? Or did you have a headache? They might say, oh yeah, but not enough to trigger an evaluation. So to me, to be clear about the terminology, I believe that there's a significant number of individuals, what do I mean? Somewhere between 5 and 15% of additional infections that haven't been detected because they're subclinical. And the only way to find those and to make them visible is to test in the moment. So those 700 dairy herds testing the farm workers weekly anonymously. I mean, give the tools to the farmer. Give him the tools so he could test his cows and so he can test his workers. Because if a worker knows that they've been not only exposed, but are infected with H5, even if it's subclinical, to give them the warning to really be careful about H1 human flu that's circulating in this moment. So this is where the vulnerability exists in the United States right now. This is not to make people fearful. I find data is liberating and makes me unfearful. So this is not, I am not fear mongering. I am saying for those dairy workers, please give them the tools that they need so that they can test both for H5 and N1 in this circumstance, H5 and H1 in this circumstances, so they can protect themselves and their families. Because even if it's subclinical, and they get H1, reassortment is much more of a risk than these individual mutations that are happening in these very sick individuals. So we saw it all the time with other viruses. Co-infection does lead to reassortment because the virus has to take over our cell machinery. And so all you have to have is co-infection in one of those cells. And so that's the only reason why I am concerned now. And I'm not concerned because I think this is going to be a pandemic. I'm concerned because, once again, we're not giving people the tools that they need in order to respond to this potential at a local level. The California Health Department is also not looking for subclinical infection and testing. And I just think, I was hoping we had learned from COVID that a lot of transmission happens between people who don't believe that they have an illness and others. And we continue, despite the WHO finally saying that there are aerosolized viruses that remain suspended, you can't see them. The only way to make these viruses visible is to provide testing to the humans. And I don't care if it's reported. I care about that human being having access to the tools that they need for themselves and their families. And I think the COVID piece and the level of the mandates, not the original mandates, but the mandates that persisted past those first 6 weeks, particularly the vaccine mandates, really caused the American people to really question public health. And we're in that situation now where we still haven't explained completely how the COVID vaccine works and how it's not like the childhood vaccines. And that, you know, that's worried me now for 3.5 years. I knew there would be a backlash from that because American people can understand nuance. I've always seen them understand nuance no matter where I work in the world. And if you had said from the very beginning that the COVID vaccine has only been studied to protect against severe infection, and the people who should be prioritized for immunization are those that have comorbidities and the people over 65, because we're worried about their infections, we would have had a very different response. And we could have explained that it was never going to create herd immunity, because that was clear from the beginning, and that childhood vaccines protect their child continuously. COVID vaccines do not protect your child continuously. And I think we would have every parent now understanding, okay, if I get the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, my child is protected through childhood and probably into their 20s, maybe into their 30s. We don't, you know, it is possible. But COVID vaccines are very limited in their duration of protection, both against infection and severe disease. Very different vaccine, very different virus. And we just need to be clear. And we really need to step back and say, you know, in 2021, we made some mistakes talking about the COVID vaccine and mandating it for everybody in the population. And we just need to be honest and believe that the American people would have chosen to gotten the vaccine if we had taken the time to explain it to them. So I think every dairy farmer wants to protect his employees. And if you give him the resources and the test, he will do that. You don't need all of this additional data collection, which I think scares people of what they're going to do with their personal information. So you can do public health and epidemiology without personal information. What you want to know is what the trend lines are, what the slope of the infection rates are, and you need to be able to communicate that effectively. And so that's why I'm frustrated. I understand where CDC is. They've made changes and it's better, but that doesn't mean that this response is going well.
Wow. Well, you just answered about 90% of my questions.
Sorry, I know I'm on a bit of a soapbox of this.
No.
I really don't. I see people being defensive about this. We should never be defensive about public health. We should be able to step back, which is, for 19 years, that's what we did in PEPFAR. We were never perfect. We were never perfect. We were responding to data in real time to make the program as good as it could be every single day. And I think that ability to use data in real time and to say, well, maybe it would be better to have more information rather than less information. And maybe there could be some clinical spread. And we have to be very honest that we didn't prevent the spread of H5. We didn't do that. That was principle number one. It's been here now, spreading and expanding for over a year. So we failed at prevention once again. So we did not prevent that spread into our domestic animals. I mean, it's been in pigs, it's been in cows. Of course, it's always been about chickens.
Yeah,
but exposure, I mean, let's be clear, farm worker exposure to dairy cattle is much higher than farm worker exposure to chickens. So anyway, that's why I'm concerned you didn't prevent. What least we could do is respond in a comprehensive manner to really look for subclinical infections so that now that we have both H1 and H5 co-circulating, we can prevent that dual infection that we're all concerned about. So to me, this is science and use of data. This isn't about finger pointing. It isn't about any of those things. It's about raising awareness in the population. And unfortunately, the word selection that is being used right now are identical to the January 2020 word selections from the very same agency, where I heard them say, there's no human to human transmission. There's no significant risk. We are carefully tracking this virus, and they were carefully tracking by symptoms. And then we found out that most of the infections were asymptomatic. So, and most of the spread was due to asymptomatic. Let's be clear, subclinical. So it's concerning to me at the agency level, not at the American people level. I want to just be very clear about that. And I'm hoping that the Trump administration, who lived through those same comments in January 2020, will really take seriously the additional reforms that have to occur in order to protect the American people. I think, Tori, if we step back for a minute, and this was any other country, the United States would be saying, I'm really concerned about how this country is handling H5 in their dairy cattle. I mean, if this was China right now, we would be saying they're not containing the H5 in their domestic cattle. And so that could be a real problem. So we just need to admit that we need to do better about containing H5. And right now we need to do better specifically just in California and potentially up into Oregon and Washington State, where H1 is dramatically rising, to really give people the tools to protect their families and our farms workers.
Yeah. You mentioned HMPV.
Yes.
Do you think we should be worried about that?
The only, okay, so this is again, and I know I sound like a broken record about testing, but if I was a parent with a 2, 3, or 4 year old, and in the Northeast, I would want to know that I could go to the pediatrician and know whether this is RSV, our current flu strain, our current H1 flu strain, or HPMB, because all of those will look identical in symptoms, as well as mycoplasma pneumonia, which has been circulating right now. So I think, why is that important? Because there's treatment for mycoplasma pneumonia, there's treatment for flu, there's treatment for COVID, there's not treatment for RSV and HMPV, except for supportive care. So I think a parent knowing, particularly if they're multi-generational household, what is circulating in their household gives them the ability, again, to proactively protect their family members that are at risk. And we know for HMPV, the risk profile is very much like flu and RSV. The very young and the very old are particularly susceptible to severe disease. So, but we've got other viruses co-circulating right now that makes them susceptible also. So, and some of them are treatable and some of them are not. And so knowing whether it's supportive care or getting them early, and there's, remember, they got to get treated early. They only have 2 days or 5 days, whether it's flu or COVID, to get that treatment. So, alerting people, and that's why I find that the CDC's expanded respiratory disease surveillance is really helpful, because if you look into the Northeast, you can see that flu rates are rising, RSV rates have not peaked, and HPMV is rising in the Northeast and the upper Midwest. So you can see those things happening simultaneously. Our flu slope in the Northeast and the upper Midwest is less than the flu slope rate of rise in California. But those rate of rises are also really critical for parents to have, because they can see how rapidly specific viruses are expanding. And I just, if I was a mom and I'm a grandmom now, I might find out what it is. Let's not guess. You cannot. The fact that we still have influenza-like illness tracking at the CDC, I find it's the 21st century. We should not be tracking any illness by syndromes, because all of these respiratory viruses that can cause fever and cough, and there's many of them, all look the same. And you cannot treat someone based on a clinical syndromic picture. That is really not right in the 21st century. So, our private sector has done incredible work developing tests for all of these diseases. And our clinicians have been using those to test, and that's why CDC can now have this expanded profile. But if we made this available to everyone and the reporting anonymous for every county, people could see. I mean, just go and look at where the labs are that are voluntarily reporting. It's not representative of the American people. There's not enough rural areas. There's not enough rural, suburban, what we call, our towns. Our towns that may have community hospitals are not well represented. And although they ship those labs, they could be attributed back to those towns. So I think it's just refining our data to be more geographically specific, because people live in geographic specific regions, so they really want to know that. There's so much we can do to make sure the American public is prepared and understands what is happening. And that is not about causing fear. That's about being honest and transparent.
I just recently went to the urgent care for my son. And while I was there, because I live in rural Ohio, I mean, I have Amish country is a half hour away, okay? So I asked her, thinking of the cattle, thinking of all of this, I said, have you had any cases of avian flu? And she goes, we don't test for it. Even the local hospital doesn't test for it. She said, because the tests are so expensive. And so, I mean, she said
How do
that.
you make them less expensive?
Yeah.
The federal government just committed a whole bunch of additional money to H5. They should be working with the private sector to make those tests available. You cannot, and once again, we're trying to only use the public health laboratories. Well, most Americans do not know where their public health laboratory is. For most clinicians, it is difficult to ship to those labs. Remember, when you're in the urgent care, all your data is automatically in the system. So if that clinician orders that test, he doesn't have to do any extra paperwork. If you've got to submit something to a public health lab, it's a lot of paperwork that you have to fill out specifically for that patient. Either electronically or handwritten. It's a duplication of effort. And so, that's an extra burden. And you can see how much they're seeing in urgent care. And we learned that from COVID. You've got to make tests available in the clinics where people are seen.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Otherwise, it's not helpful either to public health or to the individual, because if it has to go to the public health laboratory, it could take 2 or 3 days before they get an answer.
That's what she said. She said.
Remember those early COVID days when that's what we were doing? I mean, and that's when we were doing 20,000 tests a day through our public health laboratories. I applaud them. They do a terrific job, but they're not meant to be our frontline laboratories.
Right.
We have frontline laboratories that are extraordinary. And we have the private sector that is able to make tests like that. They did it for COVID. They will do it again, but they have to know that there's a market for them. I mean, so I'm hoping that some of this new federal dollars that are committed will ensure that we have expanded rapid tests, both at the molecular level and at the antigen level for individuals. I mean, in Europe right now, you can over the counter get a COVID RSV flu A B test.
Wow.
So that's what Americans need. That's what Americans want. Let's just give them the product. Of course, I'm sure there's a fee for that, but as a parent, it is a lot cheaper to test at home and telehealth than to bundle up all those kids, because moms just don't have one. They may have two or three or four, and they're putting them in the car and those car seats, and they're getting them to the doctor, and they've got this, huge group that has to go in that's getting exposed to more stuff. Going into a sick visit in a pediatrician's office when it could all be handled by at-home tests. So, we've got to do a better job. Our private sector can do that for us. I've seen them do it. We went from no tests to tests for every single platform in less than 3 months. So, and remember, H5 has now been circulating in the United States, infecting dairy workers now for 9 months. So, so we would have had in 9 months, we were doing 2 million tests a day for COVID. Now, I know this isn't COVID. It's not going to be COVID, but that doesn't mean we should put our head in the sand and ignore that it's happening. And I realize that everybody who drinks milk should be worried about our dairy workers and really want to protect our dairy workers, because they're the ones that are making that product available to us. So, let's protect them. Let's know where this virus really is, and let's open our eyes through much more testing.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, I have two more questions.
Yes.
Actually, I have a whole bunch, but you've covered them all. So my question is, I keep hearing that COVID is going to combine with H5N1 and make it this huge, horrible pandemic. Is that even possible?
No. So when these viruses combined, okay. So the thought is a good question. Because bacteria that are from different species will exchange genes, and that's how we get rampant AMR, antimicrobial resistance. So, yes, bacteria can exchange genes. But remember, bacteria can grow an auger outside of our bodies. So they don't need our cells. So it would be odd for a COVID virus to exchange genes with a flu type virus. And we've had if that was occurring, we would have seen it in the last two flu seasons, where we had pretty significant co-circulation of COVID and flu. So that is not. But can it exchange genes with another with an H1 strain? Yes, and make it so that the H5 virus can bind to our receptors. It's a little bit different. What's happening in H5 right now can be thought about very similarly to SARS. You know, it, yes, it was deadly, it was horrible, but a lot of the human infections were dead-end infections, and there wasn't a pandemic spread of SARS or MERS. What made COVID-19 or SARS-CoV-2 so pandemic was because its ability to bind more effectively to our upper and lower airways. And so, what I want to make sure doesn't happen, we don't want to make sure that the avian flu doesn't develop the same capacity. Because right now, we can, through diligence and testing and making the virus visible, both the H5 virus and the H1 virus. And I think the other thing about the COVID response that was so powerful that was done behind the scenes is it was a whole of government response. And so it brought together, Sonny Perdue was at our meetings, Department of Agriculture. So, you know, these cabinet secretaries were there and communicating with each other, and people were working together in a transparent way. And I haven't really seen all that kind of FEMA, Department of Agriculture, CDC, the entire strength of HHS, asking FDA to facilitate expedited approvals, or letting them send out a message to what you just described, your local laboratory, to say, you know, we're going to pay for laboratory design test for H5 so that we can expand testing for H5 into more communities that have rural communities that have dairy herds, so that that can be done. That can be done. That was done. So I know it can be done. I just don't know why we're not doing it now. This isn't about creating a crisis. This is about preventing a crisis. And information allows you to prevent crises. So I don't know why we're kind of pretending this is flu. Our normal flu, it isn't. And we just need to be at the public health side, giving people the tools that they need to protect their families.
Do you think we've crossed some kind of line with the death in Louisiana and the really severe case that with the young girl in Canada?
No, because those are the consequences of a zoonotic event in people that either cannot, you know, there's always individuals who cannot respond effectively to a virus. They're rare. And the virus can expand more rapidly in those individuals. And those are the ones that we see have gotten very sick and died. I mean, I don't know their genetics, but, you know, those cases are going to remain rare. What I'm worried about is the H1, H5, in California. I don't want people to believe that avian flu is tomorrow going to cause a pandemic. What I want the federal government to be doing is working as a whole of government to be able to see both H1 and H5 in real time, so that any co-infection can be found quickly. Because that's the risk.
That makes sense. I've had several people, several experts tell me that they're concerned because, and it's very similar if H5N1 gets into pigs or combines with, that's what I keep saying, that it combines or like mutates.
Yes.
Are you worried about that as well?
You know, that could happen. I think because the slaughterhouses were ground zero for the some significant COVID outbreaks, that they have more situational awareness about importance of protecting their employees and protecting their livestock. And I think, you know, they need to be proactively testing. And what do I mean by that? I mean, taking it can be even done by pool. You know, it's easy to swab a pig's nose. It's easy to swab a cow's eye. I mean, it just is. I'm sorry. You can do this pretty straightforwardly. So you can do it by pools. It doesn't cost a lot. You just want to know, is it in your herd or not? And when you know that, and that information should go to the local farmer. This shouldn't be a punitive event, or we're never going to get people to be transparent. You can't turn every disease into some kind of punitive response. You have to engender faith and trust from the American people that you're asking for this information to help them, not to shut down the farm or not to do this or not to do that. I mean, it's, you know, not to investigate the pedigree of their workers. I mean, this isn't about that. And we just have to move to that place where we provide the tools that people need without requiring personal information.
What do you say to people when they say, I don't believe this? Oh, the government's just doing it again. Or, you know, that's what the fog was. You know, these ridiculous conspiracy theories. What do you say to them?
Well, there's no incentive for the federal government to ignore or to accelerate fear among a pandemic right now. There's not an election. We're finished that. And you know, I think why they're skeptical is, I mean, let's be clear, the last presidential election resulted in people making COVID and the COVID response political. And once you do that, the American people then start to believe that any concerns are now political, that one side or the other is using it for their advantage. And we have to get past that. This is not about either side having an advantage. And we have to be clear, there are states that were run by Democrat governors that overclosed, and there's consequences to that. And there may be, and I don't think it's been well looked at, there's a perception by, you know, my Democratic colleagues that certain Republican states underclosed. But I know what the Southern states were doing, and they were not underdoing anything. They were testing to keep schools open. They were testing to keep things open. They were testing to keep businesses open and schools open. And that's what we have to remember. That's how you do it. That's how you keep things open, is knowing what's circulating and telling the people who are infected how to protect themselves
I
and prevent
think,
infection of others.
yeah, and you can use wastewater management testing, which would be, it's not expensive, it's not difficult, and it's anonymous. So, I mean,
And you can
that's another
use
way to do it.
all of the current major test providers, you know, the Abbotts, the Roches, the Hologics, the Cepheids. They can see their equipment in real time. And they get a data stream. It's anonymous. That's where I got the original data from in early March. That's what they were giving me. I asked for it, they gave it to me. Roche and Abbott every night sent me every single hospital's testing data, wherever they had equipment. That's what the private sector did. They were amazing. It protected thousands of people. I mean, millions of people. We could see where the virus was going through their machines. I think if the federal government asked them to provide that anonymous testing data on a constant basis, and we paid them just the cost of that IT piece,
Right.
not the cost of the, they're already paying for the assays through, you know, insurance, but the cost of the IT piece, and we gave the data back to them, back to all the clinics so they could see what was happening, and made a simple website where people could see the data, constantly, if they wanted to, where they just click on it and see what's happening in their zip code or their county. People would find that very valuable, and they would learn how to use that viral information to protect their children and their parents and their elderly. And that's all I'm asking for, is let's utilize the systems that we have. It's not perfect, because those systems are running positive and negative controls. And so if they only have one case and they run a positive and negative control, if you only have one, that's the positive control. So let's be clear, there are some limitations, but what becomes critical then is not the actual number, but the slope of change. Is it going up? Are you finding more cases? Are you finding less cases? And that's completely anonymous. So, I mean, those are the kinds of things that we could be doing, getting clinics the ability to test for H5, getting that data transparent and available through a central site, hopefully at HHS, because everybody has their own database and no one shares the data.
It's like, no, you can't have it. Yeah, I get it.
But thrilled to see you. Thank you. And thank you for taking the time to talk to me. I really appreciate it, Tori.
Always.